Again, I want to mention them. If you're looking to find these shiurim, they're all on YU Torah being recorded at the moment. So if you want, if you miss something, you want to catch up, then plug into that particular webpage, and you will have lots of time to close your eyes and relax. I'm sure it'll be a very relaxing experience, I hope. The stories at the end of Sefer Shoftim, there's two stories, both of which not only are very difficult stories to come to terms with what's happening, but more to the point, the rabbis initially have a problem. When did they happen? When did these stories take place? And excuse me, it couldn't be more mikatzeh lakatzeh. The opinions go from one extreme to the other. One opinion says it happened right at the beginning of the period of Shoftim, right? In other words, Othniel ben Kenaz and the whole of the Jewish people just coming in, had come into Eretz Israel, 20, 25 years earlier, and yet these stories are taking place. My own feeling about that is the question that we raised right at the beginning of the semester. How can we come to terms with the Jewish people behaving so negatively so soon, one generation after receiving Eretz Israel and two generations after receiving the Torah? It really is very difficult, right? So that's one opinion. And the other opinion, which I think is, to me, it just makes more sense, is that these two stories happen at the end of the period, as they are in chronological presentation in the book. We've gone through all of the judges, we've ended off with Shimshon, and now we're going to bring you two stories describing not individuals who are leading the people, but describing the country that is being led by these particular leaders. Sometimes in a good framework, and in these two stories, we have to say, not so good. And again, I want to make that absolutely clear, because my feeling is that these stories may very well be generic. And what I mean by generic in this sense is that it doesn't really matter when they took place, because it's not about the timing of the story, it's about the symptom that they represent. The first story of Pesel Micha, the image of Micha, is a representation of a severe problem of idolatry becoming a permanent fixture in the Jewish experience. And of course we know that idolatry never really went away. There were periods when it got a bit better, periods when it got a bit worse. During the time of Shmuel, there really was a limit, if not completely gone. Shmuel had a tremendous influence. Go to the time of after Shlomo HaMelech, and you've got idolatry all over the place. Even Shlomo allowed some of his wives to build idols, which was already a problem. So without going into sort of, as I say, the timing of when these stories took place, they represent the generic problem which existed right throughout the period of Shoftim. The first story about idolatry, and the second story about immorality. And in both cases, they are graphic in the extreme. All right, particularly Pelegesh B'Givah, for those of you who do not know the story, I'm not making any apologies about learning it with you, but it's shocking. You know, even for a storyline that the Bible can always surprise you, but this one is a shock. It's totally, not only the event, but the reaction and what happened is a very shocking story. What we're going to do in class at the moment, we're going to read through very quickly chapters 17 and 18. I'm going to get through all of Psukim, and it won't take that long. And already I want to look at some of the issues, particularly where this image really came from. There is a wild midrashic suggestion. I say it's wild because I'm not quite sure how it fits into the story. But the wild suggestion is that this is an idol, an image that they brought out of Egypt. And the suggestion is that this image, although it seems, according to the story, was made now, at this point in Jewish history, the suggestion of the midrash is that, in fact, it was made much earlier. It may have been copied, or it may have been embellished, you know, improved. But the reality is it was made an image which existed already when they came out of Egypt. And the suggestion is, this is the wild suggestion, that not only did they have it coming out of Egypt, but they took it across the Red Sea, and they even took it to Mount Sinai. And to me, I just find that so challenging, that they will stand and receive the Torah from God, and there's a whole group of people in the back there, and what are they doing? They're standing there with an idol. You know, God says, I am the Lord your God, you have no other gods besides me. And there's a whole bunch of people who've got this image, this idol, sort of, you know, cowering in the back. And it's very difficult to come to terms with that. It's much more, according to the pshat, logical, shall we say, that this is all taking place at the end of the period of Judges. The decline has happened over a period of 300 years or so, and now we're seeing how this decline was seen in everyday society. And this is a story which goes from the south of Israel to the north of Israel, goes right through the country. All right. The other shocking thing, which I want to mention in advance, is that there is a Levi mentioned here, and he becomes like the chief priest of this particular idolatry. And the Pasuk, and again, I want to refer you to it straight away, because I wanted to sort of just deal with this before we start learning it. If you look at chapter 18, Perek Yudchet, Pasuk Lamed, verse 30, 1830. Okay, that was a good year. 1830. Look what it says here. Lamed, if you're with me. Vayakimu lahem b'nei Dan et ha-pasa, the Danites, people in Dan, the north of Israel, essentially established this image. Yonatan ben Gershom, ben, what is the next word there? Page 150 in the red book. Ben, it says Menashe. Look at the way it's written. The Nun is not written on the same line as the rest of the word. If you take the Nun away, who have you got here?
Moshe.
Alright, we're talking about someone here, Yonatan, the son of Gershon. Wow, I know that name, because that's the son of Moshe. He had two sons, Gershon and Lezer. Right? And this is, in fact, Moshe's grandson. The grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu comes as a bit of a shock, because he had a grandfather who was the holiest man probably ever lived. And he, it says, they remain priests, worshipping or conducting worship to this idol till the Galut, till the exile, till the people, the ten tribes were taken away from the north of Israel many, many years later. The grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu blows the mind, should blow the mind, turns out. And he's doing a Avodah Zarah. And the Pasuk is so careful to protect the reputation of Moshe that he even changes his name to kind of camouflage it, Ben Menashe. Doesn't say Moshe, but the Nun is raised. So the idea is that, you know, we all know who it is, but we're kind of aware of the fact that, you know, to save the embarrassment of as they say in Yiddish, the Heligazeda, the embarrassment of the grandfather, the holy grandfather, we don't put his name in as it is. We kind of do it in a euphemistic way. But more shocking, and this guy Yonatan comes back again in stories later on. He has tremendous longevity. He lives for a long time. And he is the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the priest of the image of Micha. It's quite unreal. And the only way I can sort of remotely, rationalize this particular situation is that we have free choice, free will. There are many, many famous grandfathers who have very opposite grandchildren. It works in both ways. There are many grandparents who, in the religious world, were not religious. Their grandchildren are very religious. There are many grandparents who came from Europe from a very religious home, and the grandchildren have gone completely the other direction. That's the story which happened in this country so much. When people came here, came to the Lower East Side, they could not observe Shabbos properly, all right, at all. They had to work, and of course, by the time you get to the third generation, the grandchild, the grandfather tried to keep Shabbos. The third generation that moved away and went to New Jersey or went from there, who knows where, around the country, they have stopped keeping Shabbos completely. Or if they do, they don't really keep it. And the fourth, fifth generations, unfortunately, are lost, probably lost to the Jewish world. And it goes in both directions. So all I can say is that this story is brutally realistic, even though it does throw up a whole bunch of questions. How could Moshe have a grandson like that, who would eventually become the head of an idolatrous cult? He really is the head of this whole enterprise here, which we're going to read about. And there was a very famous Chavira Knesset, I think is the feminine, a member of Knesset, whose grandfather was a Rosh Yeshiva, one of the famous Rosh Yeshiva in Lithuania. And she spoke about her grandfather a lot. The only problem was that she was anti-religious. She was a member of the party, like now there's something called Shinui, that was always campaigning for change, stop the religious parties having such influence on the country. And she would vote against all the, or rather vote, bring, try and bring bills to try and make everything open on Shabbat, all the laws of Shabbat, which were maintained, the status quo by the government, he would try and change. And everybody asked the same question: how could such an illustrious grandfather end up with a granddaughter who was really so against everything that he stood for? And it can happen. It can really happen. It's one of those things that there's no... how do they say? There's no guarantees in life. All right. I just want to make that clear. It also works the other way. As I said, many, many people today have become more observant, much more observant than their grandparents and the generations before them. And that's always a very encouraging thing. It's a very encouraging thing that people are more connected to their tradition. Okay, and I find that that's an exciting thing which is happening. It's really been happening for the last 35, 40 years since the Six-Day War. That was a big change in everybody's life. All right, now, excuse me, let's have a look at chapter 17. So you got this guy from Mount Ephraim, his name is Michayav. Okay? Like, you know, as you would say, there was a man from, and his name is Frey. Okay? Don't really know who he is. But Yom Le'ima. Now, he got a strange beginning to the whole story. He's talking to his mom, right? And he says, Elefomea Kesef Asher Lukach Lach. There was 1,100 pieces of silver which were stolen from you. That number should ring bells from the last lesson. 1,100 pieces of silver. Where did we see that number previously? Sorry, with Delilah. What did she get as a reward for giving over Shimshon to the Plishtim? 1,100 pieces of silver. So along comes whatever rabbi it is and says, you know who this woman is? It's Delilah. All right? Because of the 1,100 pieces of silver. That is not a logical argument. You can say it's a coincidence, but because you're dealing with 1,100 previously of Delilah's money, and now you're saying 1,100 of the mother's money, so it's, you know, to say there's an equal sign between the two people is, let's put it this way, a bit of a stretch. But there are rabbis who want to suggest that this is in fact Delilah. That's what happened. But I don't know. I find that very difficult to contemplate, that because the money amount is the same, it turns out it's the same woman. That would be pushing it. I leave you to make up your minds about that. But he says there's all this money which was stolen, Asher Lukachlach, which was taken from you. So the son, Michael, is talking to his mom. But at Alit, you made a curse. But Gamma Mar Baznai, you said to me, Hinea Kesev Iti, Ani Lekachtiv. Well, I'm going to tell you that I took the money. That's Michael's confession. But Tomimo, so his mother said, nice Jewish mother, Baruch Bani Lashem, blessed is my son to the Lord. All right, in other words, thank you for owning up. Okay? So far, so good. So far, so good. But what happened with this money? By Yoshev, Posagimo, by Yoshev and Elev, Umea HaKesev Li'imo, gives his money, his mother, the money back. An excellent piece of, sort of child to parent honoring. Fine. But Tomeimo, so his mother says, Hakdeshik Dashet HaKesev Lashem, Miyodi Libni. Right, she says, and that money I made holy to God. To make an image. Now the big question is, how can she talk about God and talk about images all at the same time? Right? What is the obvious question from which event that we all know about very, very carefully, very closely, where the people said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought us out of Egypt, but clearly was not referring to Hashem. Obviously, that is the case of... Deathly silence here. Yeah? The event that when the Jews came out of Egypt, the worst thing that they could possibly have done. Egel Azav, right? The golden calf. How can she say, I want you to make an image, and it should be for God? Very, very challenging. We're going to try and deal with that when we look at some of the commentary. There is a reference in the Kuzari. The Kuzari, for those who have never come across it, is probably the most amazing book ever written in Jewish philosophical terms. Number one, because it's so readable, and number two, because it is absolutely brilliant. Judah Halevi, the 11th century Spanish rabbi, decided that he was going to write down a systematic description of Jewish ideas, both explaining things in Torah, in Nevi'im, Ketuvim, explaining concepts. And he puts it in the form of... Anyone know what I'm talking about? Kuzari? What form is it? It's not a story, but...
Conversation.
Conversation. Excellent. It's a conversation between the king of Khazar, whether he existed or not, we don't know. Could be that he's a real guy, or could be made up. And the Chacham, the wise, in this case the rabbi, representing, presumably represented by Judah Levi. And they ask each other questions, but mainly the king is looking for the true religion. And what is so brave about that book is that for the first 20 pages he's talking about other religion. He talks about Christianity, he talks about Islam. In the Middle Ages, when you could literally be arrested and thrown into jail and killed for saying something against another religion, and he was prepared to write this, it's remarkable. And of course, the bulk of the book then goes on to say, well, Islam doesn't do it for me, says the king. Christianity doesn't do it for me, so I'm looking for something else. And so the Chacham says, what about my religion, Judaism? And he spends the rest of the book talking about the philosophy of Judaism. It's an amazing book. And if you can get your hands on it, even to read it in English, ideally read it in the Hebrew, but read it in English, it's just phenomenal. It wasn't written, I think it was written in Arabic, if I'm not mistaken. It's something special. And there he talks about Egel HaZahav, the real essence of what the golden calf was about, and it's relevant to this discussion. As I said, we'll come back to it and we will see it. So just bear that in mind. Have a look at this. So what happened? Hey, but excuse me, Dalet. But Yashav at the Kesev Limo, so he's returned the money. But Tikach Imo Matayim Kesev at Dinei Lutzoren, she gave 200 bits of silver to the smith. What's he called? The guy who makes images. Tzoref is like a someone who's a sculptor. The Yaseu Pesel Masicha. He made it into a graven image. And it was in Michayo's house. Okay, a kind of private image. And Micha had a house of, now this is not Hashem, but Elohim with a small g, a house of gods. Alright, so he was someone who was known as having a place which represented everything that Hashem, the God of Israel, did not represent. And he made these various things, an ephod and trafim, things which were used for idolatrous worship. And he appointed one of his sons. And he had his own priest. He had a kind of parallel religious experience, whatever you want to call it. And at this point, and it's so interesting, because this you would have expected in the beginning of the chapter. And again, we're going to see, we're going to make a suggestion why it's not at the beginning of the chapter, but it's at verse 6. By Yom Imohem, Ein Melech Bisrael, there's no king. In those days, Ishe Yashav, excuse me, Be'enav Yaseh, everyone did what he thought was right in his eyes. In other words, it was kind of a lawless society. And this is a refrain which we're going to see again and again. When Shmuel HaNavi wrote the book of Shoftim, the history, and the lessons of the book of Shoftim, he cries bitter tears about these stories, and is kind of put in, I would say, in brackets, in parentheses, where he says again, by Yom Yohim, Isha Yashab Be'enav. It's like a mantra, it goes back, it repeats itself over and over again, because that's the only way you can explain the behavior of Am Yisrael, that they could do such things. In those days, everyone did what he thought was correct, not necessarily what was actually correct. And again, the question of how you can talk about God and the image in the same breath, we'll come back to that. But let's see what the story is. Zion. V'yinarmi bein lechem Yehuda. So there was this lad from Bethlehem, okay, Mishpachat Yehuda, from the family of Yehuda, v'hu Levi. And he was a Levi, all right. And this is the gentleman which I think we referred to here as the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu. We're not given his name yet, because it is very embarrassing even to mention him. But who Garsham, and he was living where Michayel was functioning with his house of idolatry. And this man went out of Beit Lechem to live wherever he could find a place to live. And that's how he got to the house of Micha on his way. So you've got Micha in Har Ephraim, Mount Ephraim, and you've got this Levite who's anonymous, who is on his way to try and find a place to set up his home, and he comes to Har Ephraim, to the house of Micha. But Yomelo Micha Ma'ayin Tavo, Supposed Tet. Micha says, where are you coming from? But Yomelo, a Levi Anochi, Mibay Lechem Yuna, I'm a Levi, Anochi Olech Lagur Bashem Sam, trying to find a place wherever I can live. All right. Remember, they're still settling the land. Individuals are still trying to find that piece of land to build their home. Vayomer lo Micha, shevay madi. So Micha said, stay here. Micha saw an opportunity. Once he said he's a Levi, that means, excuse me, that he understands that this young man knows what to do when it comes to worshipping in the Mishkan. Remember, in those days there was no temple. There was a Mishkan. So Micha thinks, if he knows what to do in the Mishkan, maybe he will help me in my house of Elohim, my house of gods. So he says, stay here, ve'yeli la'ab l'koyen, you'll teach me to be my guide, as it were. V'anochi eten l'cha aseret kesev li'amim, I'll pay you 10 pieces of silver a day, which is a lot of money in those days. Of yamim means not a day, but for this period of time. Still a lot of money, as long as it takes. I'll give you clothes, I'll give you food, no problem. He thought he discovered a gold mine. He went. So he stayed with the man. Became like one of his sons. So far, this story could have been written by William Shakespeare on a Thursday afternoon, and nobody would have been the wiser. A little story which, you know, as a pastoral tale, as they say. Young man left his home, and he ended up with another, taken in by another gentleman who offered him for the return of his knowledge. He was prepared to support him. Everything seems fine and proper at the moment. And he kept his promise, and this young lad became his priest. In other words, it's like everything's working all round. But even made Micha, he was in the house of Micha. And he still praises God. Micha is talking about Hashem. How can he talk about Hashem? He's got a house of idolatry. The whole thing is contradictory in the extreme. And this is really, once we try to sort of analyze that contradiction, I think we come to the heart of the whole story. And really not the heart of the whole story, but the heart of the essence of what the problem of the period of Shoftim, one of the big problems, was really about. The idea, I think, that people felt they could juggle more than one interpretation of deity, right, a god or Hashem, in their lives. This is, I'm just going to go for the tangent for 2 minutes. This is, to me, the greatest danger of a group like Jews for J. You don't see a lot of it here. It's gone off the boil recently. But come back, go back about 7 or 8 years, and the Jews for Jesus movement was everywhere. And they claimed that you could literally be part of two religions at the same time. Go to shul on Shabbat, and go to church on Sunday. This is what they tried to encourage people to do. And there was an advertising campaign in 2004 or 2003, where they literally took every billboard on one of the subway stations, 42nd Street, I think it was, to advertise their particular brand of what they call Judaism. And it was unbelievable. They were very successful in infiltrating into certain areas. They've still got influences on campus. In Israel, unfortunately, they have a lot more success. The government was very reluctant to stop them. And there have been stories, wild stories over the years. The reality is you can't live both religions at the same time. It's not even remotely possible. And the story in London was a very tragic story. A young man who became involved with this group in college, and he lived out of London. He would go home for the weekend and come back on Sunday to college, and they would take him to church. Saturday he went to shul, Sunday he went to church, and he became depressed. He became confused. He became really out of control. And my father-in-law, who's not alive anymore, was in college in London, and he told me about this story. And this young man became so depressed and so, I suppose the word, almost schizophrenic, that one day he just went out and threw himself under a bus, and was in, he killed himself. And I blame the Jews for J group 100% for this. It got on the front page of the newspaper in England, the Jewish news, and I think it was even on national news. It was unforgivable that they would allow or give the person the idea that you could literally do two things at the same time, have two beliefs, because Judaism and Christianity are not parallel. They are going at 180 degrees away from each other all the time, almost without exception. But that's a discussion for another time. And I just want to show you that in our Jewish tradition, going back into the very ancient world, this idea of trying to, as they say, dance at both weddings at the same time, existed. This is Micha. He's talking about the end of chapter 17. He says, God has done me a great favor. He brought me this young Levi. How can he talk about Hashem when he's talking about idolatry? So it is very challenging. Listen to this, Yudchet. Bayomim ahem, ey melech Yisrael, bayomim ahem. So again, you're getting the refrain, not quite the whole refrain. In those days, there was no king. In those days, people did whatever they wanted. In those days, ishe hashamayna. Again and again, the refrain. It's like a sort of a sad message that is coming over. And listen to this. Chapter 18, verse 1. Again, the tribe of Dan had not yet found anywhere to settle. Now again, this would suggest, some of the rabbis say, this is why this may be towards the beginning of the period of Shoftim. Would they have taken 300 years to find a place to settle? You know, if it's at the end of the period of Shoftim. So that's the question mark. Okay, so again, there are arguments one way or the other. But as I said, I'm almost convinced that the timing of the story is irrelevant. It's about what the story represents, which is totally relevant. All right, the timing could have been whenever. It's about the essence of what's going on, which is really what we're worried about. So listen to this. The tribe of Dan had nowhere to go. Kilo nafla lo adayom ahu b'tov shivtei Yisrael. They hadn't been given a portion until that moment, benachala, as an inheritance. They had nowhere to go. Vayishnu b'nei dam mishpachtav. So the whole group, which was living presumably in some sort of temporary area, sent out chamisha nashim mitzotam anashim b'nei chayel mitzara mishta'el l'ragel et ha'aretz. Chokra, they started looking for a place to settle. They needed to find a homeland. Alright? Homeland within a homeland, if you see what I mean. And Vayomer Aleim Luchu Chikret Ha'aretz, go and check out the land, wherever you want to go. Vayavo Har Ephraim. So where did they come? Of course, to Micha's place. Alright? On the way. They went to Mount Ephraim. Ad Beit Micha V'yalinu Sham. And they stayed there overnight, these five men. They were with Micha in his house. And they were there, and he gave them hospitality. He seems to be a nice guy. We're not complaining about his chnosis orchim, but boy, what his philosophical view of the world is a different story. Gimel, heima in Beit Micha, beheima kiret kol anar Levi. They arrived there, and this young lad, the Levi, had a great voice. Okay, he's the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu, and they recognized him. This is the guy from what is that? The Voice, isn't there a program like that? So this is the Voice. And what happened? By Yasurusha. They turned. They went there. So they obviously said to this young lad, "Who brought you here? What are you doing here?" You know, matal simple. That's what he says. Matal se bezeh malachabot. What are you doing here? Okay, the actual expression that is used. So he told the whole story. This guy Micha is very kind, right? I got away from home and I was wandering around, and he offered me a job, gave me a place to stay, gave me food. And it was Beiskereni, says he hired me, Beilalakoin, and I'm his priest. So, you know, everything so far sounds kind of strange, but not totally crazy. But listen to this. So they said to him, "You're in a holy place? Maybe you can find out from God," right, referring to Hashem, where we need to go. Because they have not got a clue where they're going to end up. So listen, it's unbelievable. Look at how the whole thing gets now confused. We're talking about Elohim, gods with a small g. Now we're talking about Elohim, Hashem, with a big g. And this is what they say to him, Pasuk Hey. Strange story. Ask God, Hashem. Veneda, because he's a Kohen, so he can maybe have a connection to God. Veneda tatzliach darkenu, are we going to be successful? Hashem anachu ochim aleh, where we're going. It's wild. Vayom alem ha-kohen, l'chu l'shalom. And the priest said, "Go in peace, nochach Hashem darkechem asher telchu bo," that the way that God will lead you is the way to go. Did he ask Hashem? No. How could he ask God? He's in a house of idolatry. So he gave them a kind of response, which is, as you say in Hebrew today, have an expression for it, leicha shalom, or something to that expression. Go in peace and may God be with you. Okay? That sort of thing. And that's what he said. That's what he said to them. Strange. And we're going to come back to this Kohen later on. In the meantime, these guys from Dan, don't know where to go. So what do? Vayelchu chamesh anashim, vayavoh Laish, they came to a place called Laish, vayiru et ha'am asher b'kirba, yoshev in the betach, they saw the people there living a very comfortable life, mishpat sidonim shoket u'boteh, like the sidonim, which is a group which were not Jewish, who are living also very peacefully, ein machlim davar ba'aretz, Yoresh etzer rechokim heima mitzidonim, v'davar ein lahem im adam. And again, there was nothing there. These people, the people that they came across, seemed to be living in a very comfortable place, and there was very little sign of a large number of people. It was a very small group of people, he says. Davar ein lahem im adam. They seemed to have no connection with anyone else. So what did the men of Dan do? Remember, they're wandering around the country, trying to find a nice place to live. Alright? So, vayavoh lachem, Sarah v'eshtaol. So they came to their brothers in Sarah and Eshtaol, two places. Vayomer lachem, achem ma'atem. And the brothers said, what are you doing here? Right? What's with you? Vayomer, so they said, kuma v'nale aleich. We are going to overtake that place, that beautiful place we just saw, and we're going to take it for ourselves. Alright? This is what's going on here. There's no respect for every shevet seems to say that we are the strongest, we will overcome the weakest, and we will take over. And this is the kind of situation that you're talking about in the country. It was a wild west. Look at this, Teth. We're going to go up against them, the place that we just saw, which was so beautiful. We saw the place, it was very, very, very nice. And you are quiet. Al teotsu, don't be lazy. Lelechet lavo l'reshet ha'aretz. Come with us, and we'll find a place, and then we can bring everybody with us to inherit this piece of land. So you can see that this is already turning into something a bit more sinister. All right, please bear with me on this because it really is an amazing story. People don't learn this. Yud, kevachem tavo al am boteh. All right, when you come there, you'll come to a people who seem to be secure. Va'aretz rachavat yadayim. It's a very, very beautiful stretch of land. Ki natana Elohim biyadechem, and is given to you by God. The fact that other people are there is kind of irrelevant. Bokom asher ein sham machzor, kol davar she'baretz, everything you need is in this place. Alright, where is it? It is somewhere in the north, probably somewhere now in the Galil. Okay, I'm not sure exactly where this is. Vayisu misham mishpacha adani, mitzara mishta'ol, sheish meod ish chagur, klei milchama. They took 600 men of war together with them to this place, and they were going to conquer it. Oh, they came to Kiryat Yarim, so this is very close to Yerushalayim. They called it Machane Dan, this place. This is going to be a place that comes up again in history later on, in the book of Shmuel, when the ark was captured, it came back to Kiryat Yarim, the place where the Oron was stored, till it was taken to Yerushalayim. So, again, that's kind of by the by. What's going on here becomes a bit complicated, so I want to try and make it simple. Yud Gimel. Vayavru misham Har Ephraim. After that, they went to beyond Har Ephraim. Vayavru Beit Micha. They came back to Beit Micha. So basically, what's happening is these guys from Dan went on some sort of trip to try and find someone to live. They came across the house of Micha. And he said to them, wherever you go, God will be with you. That will be the place. They saw this stretch of land which they decided to take for themselves, and this is the first place where they ended up living as a group, and it was close to Micha's house. But this wasn't good enough. Listen to this, Yudalit. What happened was that the people who went to spy out the land around Laish, you can't stay here near the house of Micha, because this is not a house of God. This is a house of idolatry. Pesel masicha. Atatu matasu. You know what you have to do. In other words, Micha's house that they thought was such a good place, now people are telling them, their own people are telling them, this is not a good place. Don't stay here. And what did they do? Tedva. Vayasuru shama vayavol beit anara levi beit Micha. They had respect for this young land who was in the house of Micha, working as a Kohen. Vayishalu lo l'shalom, they asked, how are you? V'sheish meot ish hangarim klei milchamtav, the 600 men, still wearing their weapons, Nitzavim Petach Hashar, we're at the gate of the city, as it were. Hashem Ibnei Dan of the tribe of Dan. Vayalu Chamesh Anashim, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Try and follow the story, because it's an unbelievable story. The five men of Dan went up, Auchim Ragel at Aret, Bao Shama Lachvet HaPesah at Eifod, Tatrafim at HaMasecha. They went to the house of Micha and they absolutely destroyed the house. They took as a kind of souvenir, if you want to call it that, all the images in the house, but they went and they destroyed them. Strange story, yeah.
Why would they destroy it?
Because they said this is a house of idolatry. Okay. But again, what are they doing? They're keeping all of the idols. They didn't destroy the idols, they just destroyed the building. They seem to be, and again, it's throwing up the same question. They want to do something to get rid of idolatry, right? To get rid of it in principle, but do they want to get rid of it in practice? If you see what I'm saying. In principle, yeah, let's destroy the house. Let's burn all the churches, or God forbid, or anything like that. And, you know, we'll get rid of Christianity. It doesn't work, because you may get rid of the building, but the practices are still going on. And in the sense of another religion being doing their thing, I don't worry about that. It's when we try to take their religion for ourselves. And this is what's going on here. These guys from Dan are taking all of the images, all of the paraphernalia of the house of Micha, and they're taking it with them. Because they have decided they can't live near this place anymore, even though that piece of land was so gorgeous, because it is near a house of idolatry. And they start moving north. Instead of staying in the middle of the country near Yerushalayim, they start going towards the north. You see what happens. Again, the middle of verse 17. So it says, we'll start Pasuk Yud Zayin again. Vayalu Chamesh Anashim Ha'olchim Ragel Et Ha'aretz, Bao Shama Lachvet HaPesah Ha'Eifod HaTrafim, Masecha took all of the paraphernalia away from Micha, Vakohen Nitzav Petach HaMai Ashar, the Kohen was still standing there, this young lad, V'Sheish Meot Ish Chagur Klei Melchama, and he greets the 600 men, and is not in a very healthy position. One versus 600 is never going to win. The Eila Bo Beit Micha, they came to the house of Micha, by Yichu and Pesal HaEifod, they took this image, Trafim, Masicha, the whole works. By Yoralem HaKohen, Ma Atem Osim. So the Kohen says, what are you doing here? You're trashing this place. What are you doing here? Why are you here? By Yoralem, so the men of Dan said, Acharesh, be quiet. Sim Yadacha Picha. Double be quiet. Right, put your hand on your mouth. Don't say a word. V'lechi manu, come with us. V'ilanu la'av l'kohen. We respect the fact that you know how to worship. They thought that he could sort of switch back to worship, you know, or lead them in worship. And they wanted to take with them these images. What we're going to have to say is that they honestly believe that the way to worship God, Hashem, was through the images which they were using from the house of Micha. This goes back to the Egel. What was the Egel all about? The Egel was about using an image as a means to worshipping God. What has Christianity become over the last 2,000 years? A worship of God. They talk about Hashem like we do, but they do it mainly through a third party, through an image. Christianity, do it. You walk into a church, every church in the world, you've got the cross and you've got with Yeshua, without Yeshua, whatever it is, that's the image. Judaism says categorically from the Ten Commandments, no other image besides Hashem, besides God. And this, I think, is where the whole problem lies. They honestly believe, and you want to call it, give it a title, this is a frum, a religious rebellion. It's not a rebellion against God, it's a religious rebellion. And as big a religious rebellion becomes more challenging. It's taking a concept which we understand and, I suppose for want a better word, perverting it into what they want it to be. They want to be able to serve Hashem, God of Israel, but doing it on their terms. And this, of course, you know, a lot of comparisons to many, many Judaism's isms, if you want to call it that, which exist today. It's not about following it on their terms, but you've got to follow it on God's terms. This is obviously where this story could lead. Just listen to the end of the story because it's just mind-blowing. We're on Pasuk Yutet. Hatov, middle of the Pasuk. Hatov yotcha kohen lebeit yishachan v'yotcha kohen l'shevet mishpacha b'Yisrael. In other words, they're saying to the young man, the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu, do you want to be a priest to one person, Micha, or do you want to be a priest to a whole tribe? So in other words, do you want to be a CEO of a company, or do you just want to be a manager of the local McDonald's? So the answer is, I want to be the CEO. Of course I do. I don't want to just manage one small place. So, Cha, Vayitav Leva Kohen, Vayikach et Eifod, he was very happy with the offer. So he took this Eifod, reminds me a bit of what the story of Gidon. Remember, he left behind that image, which became idolatrous. It's going back to that story as well. This is the same word again, an Eifod, like, must be like a belt. Beta Trafim, and these Trafim were like mannequins, they were images, human forms which they would worship. And Beta Pasel, and they took the graven image with an animal on it, whatever it was. Vayavo Bekeravam, and he came amongst the people of Dan, and he went with them. Vayifnu Vayelchu Vyasima Tataf Etamikneh Etakudal Ifneim, and they took all of their possessions, and off they trot. The whole lot. All of them. Man, woman, and child of the tribe of Dan, plus all the images and paraphernalia, and what's his name, Yonatan, the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu, with them. This is a band of merry men. Chafbet, hey, my rechiku mibeit micha. They go far from the house of micha. Manashim Hashem bebatim Hashem beit micha. Nizaku v'yadmika b'neidan. Immediately, people realize around that the house of micha has been destroyed, or at least it has been vandalized, and they start chasing the people of Dan who did it. So you've now got a potential for a big fight. Kaf Gimel. Vayikru b'nei Dan, they called to the sons of Dan. Vayasebu p'neim, so they turn around. Vayor ala Micha. Malacha ki nizakta, why are you chasing after him? Obviously Micha brought a group of people to try and get all his stuff back. Right? He was very upset with what they'd done. For obvious reasons. They just basically bankrupted Micha. Kaf Dalet. Vayoma, Micha says, et Elohai, my God. He's clearly talking about God with a small g. Asher siti, which I made. Lokachtem et kohen. Not only did you take my God, et kohen, you took the priest as well. Batelchu, and you went maliot. I've got nothing left. The maset toruelai malach. So what are you asking? What I'm doing? Of course I'm here. I want my stuff back. I want my priest. I want my all the various trappings of my religious worship. I want it all. And Vayomarela B'nei Dan, and the B'nei Dan said to him, and you see already the tribes don't get on with each other. Alright? Nothing new in Jewish history. Al Tashma Kol Chai Manu. Don't say another word. Don't want to listen to you. Right? You can translate this as much more extreme. Don't raise your voice. Pen Yivku Bachem Anashim Mori Nefesh B'nei Vasapta Nafshecha B'nefesh Beitecha. If you start arguing with us too much, you know what's going to happen to you? You're going to end up at the end of a sword. You're going to be dead. These are two elements in the Jewish people fighting over this. Unreal. Chavar. Vayelchu b'nei Dan l'darkam. So the people of Dan went in their direction. And of course, Micha can't do anything. He doesn't want to be killed by them. So he turns around and goes home. He's done for. Literally done. Vayar Micha ki chazakim heim amedo. They're too strong. Vayifem v'yoshem v'bito. He went home. And that's the last, I think, we ever hear of him. And he has disappeared. Behema, where did they go? The people of Dan, Kaf Zayim, almost at the end of the chapter. Behema lakhu et asher asam Micha. So he took all of his paraphernalia. Et kohen asher yalo, the kohen. Vayavo al Laish val am shoked boter. They came back to this place Laish, which they wanted to take themselves. This was one of the places they spied out. Vayaku otam lefi charib, and they destroyed it by the sword. They just literally walked in, killed all the people there, and took it over. Betair Sofu Beish, they burnt the city down. Right? In other words, they were going to build their own place, and everything there was destroyed ahead of them. Be'ei Matzil, no one could save Kirachoki in Sidon. It was a long way from Sidon. I think what happened was that this was not a Jewish place, this was actually a place. Sidon was in Lebanon, and it was not, people living there were not from Israel, they were coming from the north, from Lebanon. These are the people that were killed. But was it correct of what they did? That obviously the suggestion is no. But look what happened. With Divine Lahem in Adam, they had no connection with anybody. They were in a very secluded place in the north. Behi Ba'emek Hashem Beit Rechov. It's a valley in a place called Beit Rechov. Behimno to Eir Ve'Ishuban. That's where the city was rebuilt. And the Danites lived right in the north of Israel. Those who've been to Banyas, that whole area around there, north of Tzfat even. I think that's what we're talking about. Right up in the north. Rosh, what is it called? Rosh Pina, Rosh Hanikra. No, Rosh Pina, I think it's called up there. Very beautiful part of the country, very close to Lebanon today. Chavteh, Vayikru Shem Ha'ir Dan. They built a city there called Dan. Very original title. B'Shem Dan Avim, after the father Dan, the son of Yaakov. Asher Yulad, Israel was born to Israel, to Israel, Yaakov. V'Ulam Lai Shem Ha'ir L'Shana, but it was still called Lai. And very often the old name sticks. Listen to what they did. And this Pasuk Lamed we said, they established this image up there. But Yonatan, finally, Shmuel has to bring himself to announce who the priest was. Yonatan Begeshem ben Menashe, with a very tricky little nun there, which can be taken away at the drop of a hat. Really, it's the grandson of Moshe. Who are Banav Yukonim, the Shevet Danim, and Yonklot Aretz? They became Kohanim, they stayed up there all through the period of the first temple till the 10 tribes were exiled. And it was like a parallel universe. They had this house of Micha in the north of Israel all the time that there was a Mishkan in Shiloh, which was in the south of Israel, in the middle of Israel towards the south. This place in the north was functioning. What an unbelievably strange, wondrous story. Generic in the extreme, in the sense that, is it important that we know who the people are? Maybe just to know that there's nothing guaranteed in life, and Moshe Rabbeinu ended up with a grandson like that. But more to the point, the fact is that we see the seeds of discontent. This is a story which has within it the potential for disaster, potential for fight, potential for disagreement. The behavior of these people is very, very difficult. They seem to have a kind of sense that we can go wherever we want, we can tread and walk over whoever we want, we can take over whatever we want. We want this Kohen, we'll take it with us. We want the paraphernalia of Micha, we'll take it with us. There's no sense of doing things the way they should be done. There's always a sense of, I'll do it the way I want to do it. Ish ha-yashar be'inam. Not was yashar be'inei Hashem. Wish it was, it wasn't. Be'inam. It was correct in their eyes. They thought it was right. So they did it. And this is story number one. Incredibly difficult story. I want to give you this page, and again, we're not going to do very much of it now, but next time, I want to give it out already. We'll just pass these around. And if you have any spares, please give them back. And we're going to see a little bit of detail, particularly from the Kuzari, which is what I mentioned to you before, trying to understand this idea that they would talk about Hashem, and at the same time they would talk about an idol, they would talk about a Pesach. And there is a kind of mindset which I can only suggest is something we sort of can understand it in our day, as I said, people trying to convince you to be Jewish and Christian at the same time, which is not a good combination. Alright, I really want to mention that. You guys are lucky. Tell you a little story. There's a Starbucks over here, just on 34th. Some of you may even indulge from time to time. And about 5 or 6 years ago, somebody from Stern, one of the classes when I was talking about it, she said, oh, I had an interesting conversation in Starbucks, which probably was relevant to this discussion. So I said, what happened? She said there was a guy in there, came over, sat down, you know, where she was having coffee. She was trying to work. And he was interested in having a discussion. Wasn't trying to pick her up. I don't think it was a pickup line. It was just a, hello, how are you? I see that you recognize that maybe she was from a college, whatever. And he wanted to introduce himself. And he says he's from the tribe, a guy from Africa, I think he said, he's from the tribe of Benjamin. And she started having this interesting conversation with somebody who claimed to be from the tribe of Benjamin. Now, whether he was smoking something at the time, I'm not really sure. But the reality is that, you know, it was fascinating. Because what happened was that, again, this kind of discussion was revolving, she said, a lot of the time was revolving around religious ideas. And I think she mentioned at the time, if I'm not mistaken, a few years ago, that he believed, again, that, you know, he could combine certain concepts. He was interested in what Judaism says about certain things, but he wasn't committed to being Jewish. Why the tribe of Benjamin, I really don't know. Because essentially we claim to be descended from Yehuda or Benjamin. That's where we're coming from. So where he got his Benjamin from, I'm not sure. But there is this, and again, it was kind of relevant discussion to what we're saying here. there are people in the world, and there are many Jews, who seem to believe you can balance all of these ideas, you know, a bit of one religion, a bit of the other, like humanistic, right? Or sort of, there are other words for it. And here we're seeing a very interesting example of it in the ancient world. It's a mindset which is almost impossible for us to understand, in the sense that we believe so strongly you've got to follow a certain derech, a certain path. But these guys, again, in the time of Micha, this whole story, not quite the same idea. And again, I'm just looking at the time. I'm not going to go through it now. If you get a chance to look at section 1 on here, you've got particularly the piece, the second paragraph indented, which is the piece of Yehuda Levi from the Kuzari, is a fascinating concept, a conceptual way of explaining the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf, and saying that the same mindset that prevailed at the golden calf is possibly what was going on over here as well. It shows we are strange people, right? We don't give up easily on what my grandmother would have called Narishkeit. Narishkeit means things which are sometimes silly. There's this wonderful story I shall leave you with, which is the story of the synagogue in Poland. And every year, they used to do on Sukkot, like all shuls around the world, they would walk around with the lulavim every day, once every day, and on Shana Rabbah, the tradition is you walk around 7 times. The only thing about this shul, which was unique, right, was that at some point everybody bowed. It doesn't happen in any shul in the world except in this one shul in Poland. It's a true story. And one day a visitor comes in and he sees everybody bowing at a certain part of the circuit. And he asks around and he says, why do you bow at this point? Why do you do this? So nobody knew. And then one person said, oh, there's a guy over there. He's 95 years old. Ask him. He's been around a long time. He might know. So he went over to the guy who was 95 years old. And he said, Rabbi, why do they bow at that point? So he explained. He said, oh, I know why. He says, because we used to have a shul in the old days, much smaller. And it was very low ceiling. And there was a certain point where we got to, if we didn't bow, we actually would bang our heads on the ceiling. So we had to actually duck, and we went around. It became a tradition that at a certain point, we went around the circuit, we bowed, and we came up again. And it became our tradition to bow at that point. Now, I tell you this story, it's a true story. And why I tell you this story is because sometimes we just hold on to ideas, sometimes practices, sometimes strange concepts. Where it comes from, I don't know. You know, Canadian horrors and all the rest of it. And we, as much as you want to get rid of it, the more it becomes entrenched. Big discussions every year about kidney oats on Pesach, should be allowed to eat rice. This year about quinoa, and the whole discussion about that, and all of those things. And again, it revolves on the same idea. Once that became established, that we don't do it, for all the good reasons that we have today, that we could be lenient, possibly, the reality is, you go to Israel particularly, those who are in Israel will know, that kidney oat becomes extreme. And, you know, there, you've got to buy special chocolate, you've got to buy special this and special that. It's just unbelievable halakha. And it's all based on something which goes back a long time, and probably today is not even a problem anymore. And nevertheless, we hold on to it. There's something in the Jewish psyche that when we adopt an idea, it stays fixed in our minds. And it's very hard to budge up. And here we've got an Egel HaZahav concept which couldn't be shifted. It was shifted for the majority of the people. They went back to worshipping God. But there seems to have been a remnant, and this remnant, excuse me, this remnant became very, very disastrous in Jewish life. Eventually, lo aleinu, it came to the point where the whole country was destroyed because of it. So there is a kind of message over here. Any thoughts? Have any of you learned this before? It's a story that nobody reads. And the Pelegesh Begivah even more so. The next one. What we'll do, Mr. Hashem, on Tuesday, we'll look at a bit of this stuff. And I want to start already looking at Pelegesh Begivah. And have a great Shabbos, everybody. Thank you. Yeah.